Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this early. I think I've never done a 7:30 panel in the morning.
I did one at 6:30 once.
Early 7:30 in the morning panel, and I would like to first of all start by introducing Shoshana Zuboff, the author of The Support Economy.
Hello.
Esther Dyson of ED Ventures Holdings.
Adventure.
Okay, thank you, Esther. I've known Esther for so long that, you know, I never know, you know, what to say about you. And of course, Mark Singer, who about 10 years ago had the idea of the intermediary, who is with McKinsey & Company. Good morning. We're going to talk about digital exhibitionism, and my task is to set it up in the first few minutes. And I want to start with a metaphor which we had yesterday in the panel on transparency, which was the metaphor of having a window between one person or institution and another person or institution. So today we are not concerned with the window. The window addresses questions like privacy or security. Can I break into the window? Can I pretend to be looking through the window even if I shouldn't be looking into the window? That's not what we are concerned with today. Today we are concerned with the one-way conversation, namely the one-way quote conversation the digital exhibitionist has with the other party. Now, the other party could be another individual. Those conversations, for example, happen on Craigslist, where people with a specific intent of finding a good lay, I was told, exhibit themselves and give you details which are actually pointing toward a sub-individual. They might not be happy if the details they shared on the weekend are going to show up in the morning in their company and the work board. It could be a group on the other side, people exhibit themselves to. It could be an organization, but it could also be a government or it could be a company. So the notion we're considering today is an individual exhibiting himself, herself, digitally. So we talked about the exhibition part. Let's talk about the impact of what's specific about digital exhibitionism. What's specific there, of course, is persistence. As we know, once something released on the internet, it will always be living there forever. So not only the persistence, but also the ability to search through that. And to frame the conversation, I would like to give you my perspective of how I think there are three stages in this world of the last, say, 50 years. 50 years ago, before I was born, there was, I think, very little data about people. I had a handwritten birth certificate. My dad, just having been, you know, a few years before released out of prison in East Germany, had very few documents about himself. So there was basically nothing. 25 years ago, when I was in Germany, there was an intense discussion on machine-readable IDs. Should Bader Meinhof, should in that time it be possible to actually scan through people in groups and find out who they are? 15 years ago, 10 years ago, of course, companies, Amazon being a wonderful example, started to capture data. So that I call the first implicit data revolution. Click streams. Result for businesses was behavior targeting, inferring intention from attention. So sometimes companies sneak up behind users to look up those trails and find out, without people's intent to exhibit anything about themselves, what can they push to them? Now, that was the implicit data revolution of capture. The second data revolution, I call the explicit data revolution, and MySpace, Facebook's are wonderful examples for that. Where now, people well knowingly, explicitly reveal stuff about themselves. Now, what I want to talk about here is, what is that stuff? Why do people do it? What do they expect to get out of it? And the third step, which I just want to pull towards, is that I think what we are now seeing is the third revolution, which is the customer or the individual data revolution, where people expect something in return. It could be economic data. It could be that they get some discount. An early example for that was Amazon.com's A9 giving you a pi over 2% discount if you're willing to let Amazon see what you're searching for. It could be that I'm happy that most of my GPS locations, Nokia this year alone selling 100 million mobile phones which have GPS, being recorded in exchange to maybe not paying for updates for traffic, but getting paid and getting my updates for traffic for free. So the question I would ask here is, why do people do it? What do they want to expect out of it? And I think I would like to turn over here, having talked for my first 5 minutes, to Shoshana Zuboff, former professor at Harvard in the Business School, author of The Support Economy, to help us a little bit in the next couple of minutes frame the question of digital exhibitionism from her perspective. Shoshana.
Thank you, Andreas. Well, when we talk about the prospect of relationships between individuals and companies or even other institutions, I guess I think the good news is we can get there, and the bad news is we can't get there from here. So let's look at the State of the Union as we speak. Where are we now? We're facing a nearly complete breakdown of trust when we talk about individuals and companies. All the survey data from 2007 looks like this. I'm just going to share with you a few numbers. For example, 70% of Americans say they distrust big companies. Only 5% say companies do right by their consumers. 7% trust corporate leaders. 2% trust the tobacco companies. Well, that's no big surprise. 3% trust oil. That's no big surprise. But 4% of Americans trust their HMOs. 7% big pharma and their health insurers. 9% the car manufacturers. 12% the telcos. Okay, and it doesn't get any better than this in any industry. So that's the state today. There are no relationships without trust. And all of these mechanisms are completely broken. So that's the place that I start. How did we get here? I'm going to telescope a few ideas here very quickly. The way we got here is that we're in a new era of consumption. We've shifted from mass consumption to an individual consumer who's looking for very different things. Instead of mass goods and services, it's now about individualized support across a wide range of fundamental and intimate needs, such as healthcare, education, travel, finance, entertainment. Now, when I say support, I'm talking about relationship there. I'm talking about relationships that are based on advocacy and trust and authenticity and dialogue and mutuality and transparency and voice. Now, obviously, in the State of the Union today, there's no way we're going to achieve these things. How did it get so broken? We've got businesses that are still operating in a 20th century business model invented to address the challenges of mass consumption. Okay? That meant, mass consumption meant concentration, vertical integration, economies of scale, efficiency, low cost. And the output of that were adversarial, anonymous transactions. The consumers organized on the outside of the production process, an exogenous factor. And globalization has simply amplified and accelerated this, all the characteristics of this model. So what we've got is a massive disconnect between who people are today, what they're searching for, what they're yearning for, and in contrast to that, what's on offer. What's on offer from the kinds of organizations that we all have to depend upon as consumers. Output, anger, stress, slash margins, competitive vulnerability, and a complete lack of trust. Now, where does technology fit into this picture? For the first time, we've actually got a digital infrastructure capable of addressing individual needs in a complex way, on a global basis, with infinite configuration, infinite individualizability, if you will. But technology, there's one thing I've learned in a career of studying technology, technology is absorbed into the status quo. And it is used by the status quo to extend itself, to reproduce itself. Right now, we have the revolutionary and dramatic capabilities of the technologies that we're all involved with and we're hearing about here for 2 days. These capabilities are being driven into the old model. And the result is what we've been hearing about. Revenue models based on ads and eyeballs, cookies, tracking, surreptitious tracking, all kinds of privacy violations and controversies, manipulation. We're in a situation where eBay actually thinks it's won something when it wins a lawsuit with Tiffany and says we don't have to be responsible for authenticating what's on our platform. That's how much they misunderstand what they're doing and what the opportunities are. The output of all of this, a new generation of betrayal and pseudo-relationship. So what's the answer? This is my wrap-up. The answer is our technologies, are you a bell yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Our technologies will only, and I'm asleep, so this is really amazing. Our technologies will only fulfill their historic and dramatic capabilities in the context of a new business model, a business model designed to meet the challenges of this new individualized consumption. In this new model, the purpose of commerce is to support individuals to live their lives the way they want to live them. That means economies of trust, not economies of scale. It means assets distributed around individuals, not concentrated inside organizations. It means values realized through connecting with the unmet needs of the individual, not value created inside the organization with the model of, we make it, now how do we sell it to you? And my belief is that only when we begin to integrate our revolutionary technologies with this new kind of business model and realign all of the important key economic activities in health, education, all these things that intimately affect every life in our economies, that's when we finally put the pieces together for a new century. And that's when we see a new wave of wealth creation being ignited in a new episode of capitalism. And the wealth potential of that new ignition is likely to be the greatest that we've ever seen in economic history.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Esther, would you like to be next?
Yeah, sure. I just want to give a brief break. Did you need to come out under the table? Or?
No, we're done.
Okay.
I'm going to be speaking. I don't want to come in.
Still in the closet.
Think of it as an act of digital exhibitionism.
Yes.
It'll be a dance.
First of all, for the record, I just want to say I did not ask to be on this session on exhibitionism. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about exhibitionism and not sort of the sexy part that Andreas took, nor the, if you like, relationships with large organizations that Shoshana took. And, you know, personally, I'm not that concerned if people don't trust large institutions. I'm more concerned about them trusting other people. But what I'd like to do is explore what I think motivates exhibitionism, however you define that, and it's not necessarily sort of the psychological one, but I think this very interesting phenomenon of people going online and not simply being tracked involuntarily or unwittingly, but exposing themselves. And what's interesting, of course, is a difference that the digital world creates is it's both easier to create these separate identities in different communities because it's much easier to join different communities, but at the extreme, it's also much easier for people to reassemble those disparate identities. The stuff you do in school or online and Facebook shows up at your place of employment. The things you say in the chat room about biology end up in the legal chat room when they start going after doctors for practicing without a license or something. So the digital world both enables you to travel more broadly as your digital self, but it also enables people to come and put those pieces together in ways you might not expect. So one thing to know about me, the exhibitionist, is that I'm about to, thank you, George Church, put my entire genome up along with all my health records publicly with my name attached. My biggest problem is probably going to be spam from people selling nutritional supplements of various kinds. But yeah, so why do I want to do this? Is it narcissism? And I think there's a lot of it out there. Is it an attempt to sell an idea? Is it, you know, and it's probably a combination of a number of things. But I think people do go online mostly for attention of one kind or another, maybe for their attention. And at the attention thing yesterday, I was shocked to see people focusing merely on the attention people give to institutions and to products. I think people go online not to give attention. They don't go online always to buy products, much to the surprise of the advertisers. They go online to get attention for themselves or for their ideas. And one big question is, are they trying to get attention for themselves or for some idealized version of themselves? As one thing the digital system affords is the ability to lie more easily. It affords the ability to do whatever you want more easily. And I'm not sure that's always good. If you have a tendency to be a stalker or a pedophile or something like that, it makes it easier to fulfill those socially negative fantasies. If you have a desire to write to the president or to educate yourself, it also enables you to do that. And if you have a desire to be somebody you really aren't, it enables you to do that. But is that psychologically fulfilling? And I think to some extent, people who have unhealthy tendencies, whatever they are going to find it easier to fulfill those tendencies and make themselves unhappy. To be loved for what you are not is not ultimately very satisfying. I think that's one of the dangers of the internet. The final thing I want to say, you also probably heard me ask the question yesterday, how many Facebook friends do you have? And that was not mere exhibitionism, ladies and gentlemen. That was a genuine attempt to find out. About half the people said they knew, half the people said they didn't. One other interesting phenomenon is this thing of quantification. When I was growing up, I was very proud of being a 9-year-old girl in 10th grade. I was very proud of my SAT scores. I knew exactly how much money I had. I counted everything. And fortunately, I outgrew that, I think. Mm-hmm. But now I see people counting not just their money, not just their golf score, their weight. They're also counting their Facebook friends. They're counting, am I hot or not? How many comments did I have on my blog? How many views did I have of my Flickr photos? Again, I'm not sure that's a really useful tendency, because people are focusing on this meaningless information about themselves in what becomes almost an obsessive way. So it's self-exhibitionism, unless you're Robert Scoble, in which case it's to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. So the element I found very interesting was really whether there's one identity which we generally exhibit, as Esther and I actually do it relatively well on our blogs, and Esther suggested I tell one story here. I have my schedule up online. I've had it up online for about 15 years. For instance, you can look on Viagen.com which flight I'm taking, when I'm arriving. And interesting business opportunities have come out of this. people, for instance, have offered to pick me up in Portland at the airport, people I've never heard about before, and they said, hey, Andreas, I see your flight just landed. Would you like me to pick you up? All right, so a quick cross-check. The guy used to run sales for Lufthansa at the West Coast. He knew Andy Nori. Okay, sounds good. I mean, I know how to get after him if something is funny there. Or on the other hand, if I'm in lounges before international flights, then people know that's one of those, you know, 1.5 hours when I tend to not have meetings anymore beyond security. So that's when the press calls and says, oh, great that you seem to have time right now. We would like to ask you a couple of questions. So people actually manage, in response to the exhibitionism of saying, you know, here is where I am, to create new opportunities which they wouldn't otherwise. That's one aspect, I think, from showing stuff. That's the one identity. We might contrast this to the other one, these, what you said, some more maybe unhealthy behavior, sub-behavior people exhibit, where they wouldn't have the, you know, I'm always a vegan, almost always, that is, as an idea. So where do people have these sub-identities, and how do we deal with this as people exhibit themselves? But before we get into this, I'm turning now to Mark Singer, market director of McKinsey, works here at the West Coast with large organizations, clients who are in the business of moving from the first stage of just tracking people, stalking them, and trying to figure out what we can push to them, to the second stage of empowering people to actually contribute what they want to really contribute, to the third stage of seeing what economic models can we build on that. Mark, would you like to expand on that a little bit?
I'll do my best. I was actually just reminded of a book that we all had to read as undergrads in sociology. Many of you may have read it. It's called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life by Irving Goff. And it basically says, listen, we're all, you know, playing different roles in different parts of our lives. Those identities have different profiles. And I think there's no reason to think we're not in a different setting here. If I try to make the link to what I observe relatively large companies trying to do here, it's saying, okay, given the persona that we see here, what is it that we can do that's useful to the consumer or customer and also economically sensible for us? I was struck by Shoshana's point that we can't get from here to there. I'm hopeful that at least some companies will. And maybe the way to think about it, at least just observing how large organizations work, is that nobody likes Congress in general, but they all seem to reelect their congressmen. So, money. You know, I don't trust banks in general, but I kind of like my bank, or, you know, I dislike them less than others. So what we're seeing is that people, organizations that are able to sort out the river of data that goes by every day and start to do useful things for their customers are able to differentiate themselves in ways that we think improve the overall proposition, improve trust, and are leading to wider differences between top quartile and bottom quartile performance in lots of different industries. So the art of the possible in terms of what we can do with customer information has changed at such a remarkable pace. I mean, the last two nights we've all gotten these little key fobs in our rooms, right? Which I think in 1992 terms is a couple of $1,000 worth of storage. So I think that large organizations haven't figured out how do I actually get the few buckets of data out of the river that goes by every day, keep it act on it in useful ways. So we all know large organizations don't change quickly, and so we're racing as large organizations to keep up with this. And it's quite difficult, especially in a multi-channel setting. I mean, I think we all admire what Amazon does with many of us admire what Amazon does to make it easier for us to find things we're interested in based on our history with them. And but in a multi-channel setting, it's actually a lot more complicated. People are encumbered by legacy data and so forth. So what we're seeing organizations doing, and I'd say not consistently well, and I don't think there's anybody I would hold out there as the model, but a combination of a look in the near term, what is it that I can do with the data that's available today, and what data is likely to become available over time, and what kind of a profile do I want to establish for my customers over time to be useful to them, and do that in a way that I'm quite proud to expose that to somebody over time. And ultimately, and maybe this comes back to the exhibitionism, is I'll let somebody populate that profile. I'll share it with you. Here's all of what I know about you. I'm happy to let you add things over time if you prefer, and I may allow you to shut things down, you know, down to the limiting point. I have to have some information to be able to do business with you. So that combination of a near-in focus and a longer-term focus in parallel, my former colleague John Hagel called it a bit of a bifocal strategy, I think is what we characterize folks as being successful.
Now, we all had our 5 minutes here. Looking at the audience here, where we have Peter Hirschberg, the rise of the audience, which is sort of a not an individual exhibitionism, but a mass exhibition, or what you might want to call it. Or with Chris from the early days, Delicious, where people could actually plant seeds, little breadcrumbs of what they're interested in. Bill Gross, who had most of the interesting ideas, I think, which, you know, the internet is built on here. Or Peter Schwartz, or last but not least, Rob Hoff, who coined the term from e-business to me-business, where we actually are in the center, as opposed to where the company is in the center. David Bossart, who runs a whole think tank on what people actually do and how they think about retail. I really would love to open it up to see what you have to say, what questions you have. I personally think that the questions are at least as important as the answers here. We are very early in this stage, and I think on that note, I mean, Esther.
I just want to respond to one thing Mark said.
Yep.
And actually, Shoshana as well, since we raised the issue of trust, I think you gain trust by being open. And so my relationship with American Airlines is very intense. And I don't trust them to have my best interests at heart, but I do trust them to want me to be a good customer. I find them predictable. I can check their seat maps. I would gladly tell them all my travel plans if they wanted to be my friend on Doppler. And it's not, but I have no delusion that they're a person that loves me. And I think part of transparency is being explicit about what you are and what your motivations are. And American Airlines' motivation is to keep me just happy enough to have me remain a customer. And I understand that. I don't find it a problem. And I think the businesses need to understand transparency is not creating a cool personality. Transparency is being predictable and making their motivations clear.
Now, what do you do when you don't agree with the motivations? So when you, as it happened to me last week when I was flying out to Boston, was told, well, you could have the nonstop, but that would be another $1,500 right now. Yes, I understand that they're optimizing their profit. I also understand that the poor lady at the 1K check-in really has no degree of freedom here. Is it that, you know, we are just, you know, getting annoyed about this, or is there a chance how actually we could move out of that? So I think that's one of the questions I have. Okay, so I know that Chris had his hand up very early, Peter as well.
So I wanted to comment on Esther's discussion, and I think I agree with everything you said on the positive and negative sides of exhibitionism.
What else is there?
Pardon?
What else is there?
But there is one word you use. You called the interest in number of people, friends, following meaningless. Mm-hmm. And I take very much issue. I think it is extremely meaningful to the people that are involved. And I think, you know, you talked about this book I'm gonna get called Presentation Itself. I think a current version of that is in video from PBS Frontline. It's called Growing Up Digital. If you haven't seen it, it's just a great insight into what it's about being a kid growing up on Facebook and the good and the bad. But I think it is very meaningful to these people.
Oh no, I'm not saying the friends are meaningless. I'm saying it's 8:43 versus 9:22. Do I have more friends than you? What's meaningful is the quality of those friendships, not the number. It's the quantification. Right. Sorry, that was my mistake if I wasn't clear about it. It's the quantification of all this stuff.
Duly noted.
Yeah.
Peter Schwartz.
I have two questions, because I came here because I really don't understand what's going on. And you know, I was one of the 12 people who yesterday didn't have a Facebook page. And somebody who, you know, was decrying the fact a number of years ago that the privacy was over because everybody would be able to penetrate our identities in so many different ways, only to discover that actually everybody was throwing open the windows, the doors, taking the roof off the house and showing themselves off in every possible way. And so I don't understand, I was astonished yesterday when everybody put up their hand. I would think almost everybody would desperately want to not reveal themselves, not, you know, there's so much stuff out there. I get so much stuff written about, I don't want to tell anybody anymore. And I didn't understand it in this room, don't understand it with my son, his friends, and everybody else who's online. I don't understand what has happened to transform such a large part of our culture into the desire to not merely express in a creative sense, but just simply reveal, okay, here's all the things about me that anybody would wish to know. And I don't understand the motivation, I don't understand the behavior, and I open it up to anybody to answer that question, because I just don't get it.
We might not be in the business to really know the answers here, but I think it's a good question. Anybody has something direct to respond to this? Esther?
In some weird way, I think it's like your sex drive, which is to put your DNA all over the place. And this is to put your digital DNA, your memes, your presence everywhere. And so what you see now, moving from I'm on a single Facebook page, now I have these widgets and other things, so that I'm present on other people's pages. And even when I'm asleep or in a meeting here, all over the internet, little bits of me are being present for other people to see and interact
so
with.
So when you sent me an email telling me that you had pictures on Flickr of Kathleen's garden, is that what you're doing, is just proliferating your identity?
In some weird way, yes, presumably. I mean, you know, I do it too. There are lots of things I do I don't quite understand. But, yeah, I mean, I wanted you to know that. To me, it's sort of an expression of what I see. It's interesting, and it is my presence out in the world. I've stopped blogging.
So we could essentially say that there are several ways of making yourself immortal. One is to spread your DNA, which actually, as a principle, leads to very different female and male behavior. Another one is to spread your digital DNA.
Yeah,
your
and pictures. You don't need sex to do it, or another person, for better or worse.
So there were a whole bunch of people, I think.
So this is a different question, maybe as a follow-up to Peter.
Yeah, who does a follow-up?
So I guess what we're talking about is actually breakdown of our society. We used to have a society in which actually everything was clearly organized. You all lived in one house, you had your grandparents there, your parents, the kids, etc. And it was easy, it was simple. And I guess everybody knows how great sex is when you get to it, but how frustrating it is to do the digital form of sex. And in a way, the society tries to recreate themselves digitally because of the breakdown of the real sexual society in having sex with a person. So. I think that's where we got to.
I think it's overstated in terms of
pseudo-intimacy.
We have Shoshana, David, and Peter Hirschberg.
Well, I agree, Peter, exactly where Alex is going, because I think you need to step back from kind of the two sides of this conversation and see how they're connected. Because what I described was a large-scale phenomenon in which, as individuals, we have been abandoned by our institutions, both public and private. And of course, we can all, you know, work out our little pathways through the detritus that may work for me today. I can paste it up and make it work. But the big picture is that the system doesn't work for us as individuals. Now. With decades of this experience, my sense about the answer to your question, Peter, is at least one piece of this can be explained by the fact that we have so few channels for voice in the organized social world, whether through our public institutions or our private institutions, because they're organized in relation to a mass. There are not individual channels for voice, and our voice doesn't make a difference. and we don't feel like we have direct influence.
Do you think that explains Facebook?
I think that the rapid rush into these new channels, the blogosphere, social media, how we see, as soon as those channels opened up, there was a huge rush into them, and all of this suppressed and pent up need for voice and individual expression, and this is me, and this is who I am, and the whole organized world doesn't want to connect with that, but with each other, we go to each other to express that voice. So you look at the survey data, and in country after country, a majority of people say, I trust the ordinary man or woman on the street, but I don't trust the companies who sell me things. I don't trust the government, the elected officials, et cetera, et cetera. Because we've gone to each other for that experience instead of our institutions.
That's interesting. Actually, I saw a survey from China which very much supported that as well. That it's really the ordinary man, and they call it the tectonic shift of trust.
But I mean, just excuse me, but I spend time in Russia, and that's where people really don't trust the system. And you will not take a taxi from the airport because the guy picking you up is probably a thief. And it's just not that bad here. I mean, let's not make Russia the standard to compare ourselves.
David Bossart.
Yeah. Probably it's very simple. It's like obesity. It's social contagion. So it happens. It's there.
I'm sorry, we couldn't hear you.
Obesity, contagion.
It's like, yeah, contagion. Yeah, it just happens. But the answer is basically, with every answer we find, we have to be aware that there are two new questions arising. And this is happening too here again. So I guess in a networked economy, it is sort of contagion that is going on. And it is here.
You know, I love Peter's comment because all of us are so in this kind of new world that's only existed for 4 years of social media, and we've come out of these older values. McLuhan had this great line that we shape our tools and forever after they shape us. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is how this generation is really living as a media company. We manage and we shape brands. People, you know, form their Facebook pages as if they're a media company and keep track of the links because they need the overnights. And that's, you know, a technorati, we saw this all the time. It's how people were keeping score. And so, you know, in the era of mass communications, we all learned to be mass fans. So it was, you know, we adored big brands and we adored famous movie stars. In a read-write world, it just realigns itself, and suddenly we ourselves project ourselves out there. And I think this is part of what's happening with brands. In a read-only culture, you know, brands with these wonderful icons, and you know, we said things like a brand is a promise. In a read-write culture, you can't just be an icon, you have to be in some kind of meaningful dialogue. And brands are just figuring out how to do this. And so it's some combination of they do it lousy, and initially they do it inauthentically, and so they piss people off. And the good ones that do it well get a pretty good advantage. So we're kind of learning all of this stuff, but it's happening in real time over the last 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, the subtitle I chose for the panel was The Future of Relationships, whether actually the exhibitionism is part of the future of relationships. And if you think about that, people have no problem relating to each other now, not only through Facebook, but of course mobile phone, text message, and so on and so forth. But what has not happened is the same ease of relating to companies, your favorite airline, to the government. So there are simply questions that the pent-up consumer or individual demand, Shoshana mentioned, was able to be filled more quickly, that vacuum was able to be filled more quickly on an individual basis than it was able to be filled by companies which traditionally often see actually customers as the enemies, the people to be avoided.
So
if you introduce yourself.
I went through a really troubling exercise about 2 weeks ago where a batch of kind of middle-aged guys like me sat down in a series of terminals with enclosed and test network with totally commonly available hacker tools. And in about 2 hours, we're able to put child pornography on anyone's computer, completely disrupt bank accounts, change the kids' grades, and things like that. And if you look at some of the tools out there, like Multivo and Curva, that put together a picture of you, your total web presence, it really becomes an identity theft problem of non-trivial proportions.
Well, let me understand the two things, because I thought this is the opposite. On the one hand, if you have a really broad presence on the web, it seems very difficult to then change, you know, things in this, because there were multiple copies, multiple aspects, multiple views of the same thing.
You're not trying to change. What you're trying to do is, what you're doing is open yourself up to some random person whom you do not know, who is capable of doing genuinely serious harm to you, for whatever reason. I mean, they can, so it can be revealed that you have child pornography on your computer.
Oh, that's different from you putting, you said
yes.
You put child
on
pornography
someone else's
on
computer.
Someone else's computer,
someone,
right.
Someone did this to you based on the openness, and the more open you are, the easier it is to do. In addition, you can put together a profile of yourself, someone else can put together a profile of you that lets you now, lets them now masquerade as you in a number of different situations, whether it's financial or social or whatever. And so, this is kind of the point, perhaps, of the downside of the positives you get from sharing. But I think the downsides are perhaps more potentially damaging than a lot of people, certainly young people, now realize.
So I think actually very interesting. If, and David Holtzman makes that point, if we actually really were complete digital exhibitors all the time, there would not be any identity theft possible anymore. He's pushing the point. But there's some truth to this. The more society knows about me, the more difficult it would be to impersonate me.
I feel like, in a way, we're a bunch of Martian anthropologists trying to understand Earthlings, and I don't feel like we're going to get it. I don't think we're capable of really understanding these phenomena as much as we'd like to try. I mean, obviously, we should keep observing them, but I tend to think, I feel like there's a slightly negative kind of past in the room about what's going on. I don't feel very negative about it. I know there's a lot of issues and there's lots of danger. I see it more on a societal level as leveling the playing field and letting more people do what they want to do.
Yes.
And I totally support that, even though I hate the consequences that often show up in my mailbox or on my computer. But I also think from individual kids' points of view, especially if we're looking at like 13-year-old to 24-year-olds from their perspective, I don't think it's exhibitionism or voyeurism or anything. I think it's just people wanting to communicate in a new way. And you know, we may have just made it to the email generation. You know, some of us. My kids are way past that. They're not into email. They think that's the way they communicate with their parents.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I communicate with my wife, who's across the hallway in her study. You know, so, but kids don't do that. And I think to be able to communicate in the way that they choose to communicate, it requires revealing something about yourself. If you don't reveal something about yourself, you're not a genuine person. And so I'd like to try to think, on the more positive side, how can this be leveraged? Because this is really, like Peter said, it's like 4 years into it. It's so early. I don't think it's a good time to judge whether it's a good thing or not.
Mark. So I was just going to say that there are positive examples. I see organizations trying to sort out how do we act on this information in valuable ways. I suspect in the room, lots of folks have seen this. In your American Airlines example, they got lots of ways to communicate with me now when they actually fail to do what they're supposed to do. At least they let me know by,
yes,
text message and, an email and a phone call, so I can at least adapt. And I don't have very high expectations either. And as long as they meet those expectations, until somebody can reinvent this model, I'm happier with, their ability to use my information.
The lady at the opposite.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoy this conversation. Karen Lajewski from Virtual Distance International. And I just wanted to tie a couple of points together about trust, especially because it's the fundamental building block of relationships. We were talking about this yesterday at the Peace Conference. But I think it's important for us to start to get more granular, at least at this level, about types of trust, right? Because, as we all know, there's stuff called contractual trust, cognitive trust, okay, without getting too academic. But it's the kind of trust that is okay to have, with an organization. An organization should try to actually build good cognitive contractual trust. But the type of trust that drives innovation between people that absolutely has to be in place, this isn't just my research, but other research, is affective trust, a very deep trust and loyalty where you're willing to take risks with other people and give them responsibility for your own performance and vice versa. And so at the organizational level, if we're going to begin to develop relationships, online relationships, that spark innovation and creativity and that kind of thing, then we have to go for the affective trust, the very deep types of trust that we form with our most closest friends.
Denise Caruso from Piper Figure, I want to follow up on that too. Another term for that is social trust, it's how people actually in the real world can look at each other and decide whether or not it's okay to transact. But I'm curious as to where Doug's point meets Lynn's point, because at this point, there is a lot of exhibitionism, quote unquote, but I haven't heard, identity theft is way up. And so what happens when the generation of teenagers starts getting their identities ripped off? And there's actually financial consequences to that. And so I'm interested in that, not from the social perspective so much, but I mentioned this yesterday in the breakfast meeting too, it's like, at what point does somebody have to step in, government, someone, to allow, to sort of not mandate the specific technologies, but where do you have to start protecting communication so that those communications are less likely to be ripped off. I mean, there are ways to move around on the network where your personal information is actually protected and you can still expose the information that you want. But at this point, everybody has to go to, if you go to Facebook, you put all your information there. You go to MySpace, you put all your information there. It doesn't go with you, you can't control it, you can't mandate in any sort of meaningful way who gets what and how. And so, is there any movement in the policy world?
There's a couple of different questions here. The first one about identity theft, the reason it's so common is that people aren't scared enough of it yet. If it becomes common enough, it's fairly easy to take strong protective measures, like not beyond the simple password, which is incredibly breakable, to two or three token-based identification schemes. So that's one side of the coin where you want to establish a unique identity, and like it or not, you want that strong and somewhat cumbersome means of establishing your unique identity. At the other end, there's the issue of people want to not be anonymous but be private, and as you say, simply reveal a credential or two. Again, as it starts getting demanded, it's going to happen more. I think Facebook is teaching people the granularity of to whom they want their information revealed and to whom not. We can't solve the problem of people. And I got an email from some guy who's lurking around here who's not attending the conference, who's got a completely uncrackable computer system, and Lynn, you should check it out. The problem is you can't protect a computer system against an employee who goes bad, like the thing in San Francisco. You can't protect a computer system against somebody who's socially engineered into giving up his password. The problem isn't with the technology, it's with people. And I could give a photograph to somebody and then they could send it to the New York Times. The mere fact that I can email it, I may be untrustworthy. The moment you give me some information, you can tell me at a cocktail party about your indiscretion. I can tell George and then he can tell Mark.
But I think more interesting, I get all that,
yeah.
And I think that the more interesting thing is almost on the organizational level, where isn't there a law now that requires organizations who have been hacked to actually say that they have been?
Right.
So I think part of the reason people don't get it about identity theft is that because organizations have been hiding it for so many years.
Yeah, And I just got an email from CNET because mine was hacked 3 months ago, along with some Google employees. And it's very slow.
What
and
did you do about it, Esther? Did
nothing.
You just let it go over your head like everyone I've gotten that done?
Yeah, absolutely. I also sat next to the plutonium, or I was on the plutonium plane, and I got told by the British government to go get tested. And I waited 3 days. Nothing happened. And
Bill Gross.
It's only 5 minutes old from what you said, so I don't know how good this is, but think about what Esther was saying about we want to spread our DNA, and think about how all humans want validation, and you start out as a teenager, and you're looking for those things desperately at that time, and we as teenagers had the tools available to at that time, and we grew up the way we grew up, and we learned how to achieve our validation and spread our DNA with the tools we had. And now I take a look at my kids as teenagers, and they're looking for those things desperately, the same things. As you said, Peter, there's different tools now, so they adapt to those, and they desperately find a way to express themselves, to get the things they need. We grew up, and we got past that, so now when we look at those tools, we say, well, we don't need that much. We already learned how to achieve those things, the things that we're looking for, the validation, like you were saying. I already have people talking about me. I already have friends. What do I need to do that for? And yet, if you're growing up with those things, you're desperately looking for that still, so you adapt to those. So I think it's just we all find them in our own ways with the tools we have at that time.
Why did everybody in this room have a Facebook page?
Why do they?
Why?
Well, I think we maybe get dragged into it, but we don't need it quite so much. We're not quite so desperate about it. As
how many use their Facebook page?
I do.
I wanted to add something here. I mean, I think the simple answer is it allows all of us to be in more than one place at the same time.
Like Esther suggested, just to proliferate our identities.
Well, I mean, not necessarily so much in a narcissistic way, but in a practical way. I mean, it's like if you've got, I mean, by having a Facebook page, I can be here, but then I can also be a bunch of other places too. We all have, I think, intuitively wanted to be able to do. From the moment we had any sort of self-awareness. I mean, I'd like to be here talking to all of you, but then there are four or five other places I'd like to be as well.
So I know that
I can't physically split myself, but Facebook allows me to do it.
Thank you. I know that about seven hands up. Jeff, I want to have...
That actually brings me back to a point that I wanted to make a little bit earlier about the relationship with, say, myself or yourself and American Airlines. I don't believe that they actually are relating to me. I think they're relating to something that I have created, right? And that's perfectly fine. And I can create all these different sorts of replicas or layers of myself to present to different companies, individuals, or whatever, right? I think it's actually a new freedom that we have with these sort of tools. And,
well, you have agents.
What's that?
What they used to call them agents.
Exactly. Right. It's an agent, it's an avatar, however you want to think it. And I think that's incredibly powerful. We're going to have the tools to also manage those sort of things, just as I used to get inundated by incoming communications to that agent. I now have spam filters and these sort of things. So we'll have these tools to, you know, replicate ourselves, as you're pointing out, and tools to manage the conversations that we would like to have those agents engage with.
So I would like to wrap it up here. And saying it's interesting that one of the underlying currents here was the difference between transaction economics, like in American Airlines, they give you a piece of paper and they are done. Good luck, young lady, to find the plan. Versus relationship economics, and actually I really deeply appreciate Amazon and Jeff Bezos, and one of the things which always is clear there is that ultimately it's about helping you to find stuff. Whether the transaction happens or not is secondary. So, on that note, I would like to turn over to Shoshana and see whether you might have any final words about where this might be going.
Well, my summary comment would be something like this. The pieces of this conversation are all connected, and I think that's the hardest thing to grasp is that integration. And the way I do it is to step back a little bit and try to see a little bit more from an airplane view. And when I do that, what I see is, on the one hand, institutional breakdown. For example, we spend, in America, $230 million an hour on healthcare. The latest statistics just out this month show that Americans are ranked number 42 in life expectancy among the developed countries. All right, this is institutional breakdown. Obviously, we're not going to get into the whole analysis of it now. We can say, oh, well, it's not about organizations or it's not about companies, but it won't be about big companies as we know them today. But having said that, we still need health care. We're still going to get sick and we need to get fixed. We need wellness. We need all of those things. We've got 16% of the GDP of the American economy wrapped up in all of this activity. And then there's education, and then there's all of our other major industries. So we've got that on the one side. On the other side, we have the social media that has started to be a place that we go to solve our problems for each other. Because institutions have abandoned us, when I come back from the doctor's office and I only get 7 minutes to talk to my doctor because she's got her productivity measures that were installed in her hospital by McKinsey. Oops, sorry, Mark. So I go home and I get on the web, and the first thing I do is look for somebody else who has this problem or who knows what it is, and I go to the websites and I look for chat rooms. We go to each other now to get help to solve our problems. We go to each other to get the attention, to get the feeling of connection, to feel accompanied, which is a lot, I think, of certainly as I interview my children and their friends about their Facebook experience, it's feeling accompanied. You know, people are with me even though I'm sitting here in this room alone. We build community. So where I see in 5 or 7 years, if we're sitting here talking about where social media is going, what we're going to find is that what now looks like it's merely Facebook, Peter, and it doesn't seem like it has a point, maybe, we're going to take these things that are really meaningful and working for people, and we're going to figure out how to use those methodologies, those processes, those technologies, those experiences to tackle the things that all of us really need, like healthcare and like education. You know, and you get these little fragmentary suggestions, Live Mocha, a place where people can go and teach each other different languages, right? And that begins to address big things like education. I think we're going to be seeing that as the next generation of where social media goes.
And in the spirit of social media, I will put up a transcript of our little discussion here on my blog, weigen.com, and invite you to comment. Those of you who didn't get the word, I apologize, but in the interest of time, we need to close, and I would like to close to once again thank both the audience and thank Shoshana.